Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. President Trump made two big health care pledges during Tuesday night's State of the Union address. First, reducing the price of prescription drugs. He's railed about this since the campaign trail, accusing drug companies of getting away with murder and being open to having Medicare negotiate drug prices. But now he's president, and Big Pharma has his ear, and a former top pharma executive now leads Health and Human Services. President Trump also committed to giving patients better access to experimental treatments, so-called right to try. This hour On Point, an examination of President Trump's medical checklist. You can join us on air or online. Do your prescription drugs cost too much? Can President Trump deliver on his promise to cut prices? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we're going to be talking about a plan by Amazon, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway to try to cut the healthcare costs for their workers. But first, Trump's pledge to lower drug costs. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Dylan Scott. He's a policy reporter for Vox who covers healthcare. You can link to his piece headline, State of the Union, Trump's Abandoned Promise to Bring Down Drug Prices, at our website, onpointradio.org. Dylan Scott, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by listening a little bit from Tuesday night, State of the Union address with President Trump talking about one of his greatest priorities. Here he is.
In many other countries, these drugs cost far less than what we pay in the United States, and it's very, very unfair. That is why I've directed my administration to make fixing the injustice of high drug prices one of my top priorities for the year.
One of his top priorities for the year. Dylan, what does President Trump actually propose to do about making that one of his top priorities?
Well, I would say for starters that we have certainly not seen any grand sweeping plan from the Trump administration about how they're going to bring down drug prices. There just hasn't been any kind of, you know, broader strategic vision laid out over his first year in office. And now to the president's comments in his State of the Union address, you know, that may be something that we do see coming later this year. But at least for, you know, the first 365 days, we did not see any sort of cohesive policy plan from the Trump administration on drug prices. Instead, for the most part, they were doing what I would say is kind of working on the margins. The folks at the Trump administration's Food and Drug Administration did approve a record number of generic drugs, which is actually, you know, certainly something that increases competition and should make cheaper drugs more available to people. They have proposed some pretty in the weeds changes in the Medicare program to address the out-of-pocket costs that people pay for their drugs under that program. But all of these things, I'd say, are certainly on a much smaller scale, considering some of the rhetoric that the president has deployed, both as a candidate and since he took office.
Yeah, and I want to listen to a little bit of that let's listen to a little bit of that rhetoric as a candidate. So, for example, here he is, January 2016, campaigning in New Hampshire. Then candidate Donald Trump said he could save billions. He could save Medicare billions of dollars by bringing down drug prices if Medicare were allowed to negotiate drug prices directly with the pharmaceutical companies. Here's what he said:
drugs with Medicare, they don't bid them out. They don't bid them. They pay like this wholesale incredible number. Hundreds of, they say like $300 billion could be saved if we bid them out. We don't do it. Why? Because of the drug companies, folks. You take a look at the drug companies. Take a look at Johnson & Johnson. Take a look at Pfizer. They're leaving us, and we're still not doing anything.
And here's another bit of tape. This is from an October 16th cabinet meeting when President Trump suggested his administration will take action against high prescription drug prices. And again, he singled out the drug companies in a big way.
You look at the same exact drug by the same exact company, made in the same exact box and sold someplace else. Sometimes it's a fraction of what we pay in this country. Meaning, as usual, the world is taking advantage of the United States. They're setting prices in other countries, and we're not. The drug companies, frankly, are getting away with murder.
Dylan Scott, the drug companies, frankly, are getting away with murder. He said that often on the campaign trail as well. Is he really got the drug companies in his sights? It's hard to believe, given some of the choices he's made to fill his administration.
Yes, I think that's true. And yes, to your point, you know, I think President Trump and candidate Trump especially very specifically called out the pharmaceutical industry. I don't think there was any ambiguity in who he was portraying as the villains in this storyline about high drug prices. And he wasn't afraid to talk about it in sort of the most visceral terms. I mean, getting away with murder is about as strongly as you could put it. And notably, I followed Bernie Sanders around Iowa during the Democratic primary, and that is the exact language that Bernie Sanders would use to describe the drug industry. And so he very clearly in sort of his rhetoric and in the way he tries to present himself to the public wants to put himself as at odds with the drug industry because, you know, the drug industry is not exactly America's favorite sector of the economy. And, you know, they're a pretty easy villain to portray. But to your point, the most interesting thing that we've seen during the Trump administration itself is that we're not really having a discussion about drug prices anymore. We're not talking about the prices that a brand name drug company sets when they introduce a new drug. Instead, we're having a much more nuanced discussion about what I would call out-of-pocket costs, the actual money that everyday Americans are paying out of their pocket for their prescription drugs. And that's really more of a discussion about insurance benefits, about co-pays and rebates. It's not really about the prices that drug companies are setting when they introduce new drugs, even though, again, I think without much ambiguity, candidate Trump especially was talking about, he was talking about prices and he was talking about the drug companies. But now, in actuality, we're really talking about insurance benefits and the insurance industry and pharmacy benefit managers and all these, this other sort of cottage industry of healthcare administration that relates to pharmaceuticals, but isn't really about drug prices per se.
Right. So a real shift away from that sort of campaign trail, putting the big drug companies in his sights. So how does the confirmation of Alex Azar as Health and Human Services Secretary change the conversation as well, knowing that Azar is a former big pharma executive, a former CEO of Eli Lilly and Company?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. You know, I think we, of course, have to give Secretary Azar, a little bit of time to get settled into office and figure out what he's going to do. He just got sworn in on Monday. But yes, I think, you know, he is sort of the quintessential example of the way that, the perception is that the pharmaceutical industry has very successfully courted the Trump administration. Here is a guy who, as you said, worked for Eli Lilly for years. He was actually in charge of drug pricing during his confirmation hearing. Democrats in the Senate were going through lists of drug prices that had been hiked during his tenure at Eli Lilly. So, you know, it on its face, it seems certainly hard to believe that this is the person who's going to sort of finally ante up and pursue an aggressive agenda on drug prices in the Trump administration. I do want to say, you know, going back to your point, you know, we were talking before about Medicare negotiations.
Yeah.
And obviously that's kind of one of the most there's the politics of Medicare negotiations, and then there's the actual sort of more nuanced policy discussion. And very clearly, President Trump tapped into the politics of Medicare negotiations. It sounds good to say we're gonna more aggressively negotiate with the drug companies to bring down the prices that Medicare pays for prescription drugs. The policy side of it is a little more nuanced. What the drug industry would tell you, and what Secretary Azar, he sort of took this line himself during his confirmation hearings, what he said is that actually, you know, the for people who get the prescription benefit in Medicare is actually administered by private insurance plans right now. And so those private insurance plans for Medicare Part D do some negotiations with drug companies as they try to figure out what they're going to pay on behalf of their Medicare beneficiary.
Got it.
And
okay.
So yeah. You'll hear a lot that, you know, there already are negotiations in Medicare. And like I said, Secretary Azar made note of that during his confirmation hearing. But the one thing he said that stuck out to me and that I think is interesting is he also talked about Medicare Part B. That's the outpatient a separate part of Medicare that has to do with covers doctors and hospital care. And he said, you know, maybe there are some things that we could look at in that space to introduce more competition or try to bring the prices that we pay in Medicare Part B down. And so I thought it was at least interesting that he had clearly thought through this enough to have an intelligent discussion with the senators at his confirmation hearing about Medicare negotiations, and it seemed at least open to doing something in that space. Like I said, I mean, this is quite literally his first week in the job, so it remains to be seen whether anything happens.
It remains to be seen. Yeah, exactly. Quick question, Dylan. We're coming up against a break, and I just want to get this question out before we run out of time. What's next? Where do we go from here? And what will Congress do with this pledge? Is there any action there?
So I think Congress has talked about some relatively minor legislative changes, stuff that would require brand name companies to share more information with generic companies, which again could help bring more generic competition into the market. But right now, I think barring the Trump administration really deciding that this is something they're going to bear down on in year two, the status quo is probably going to persist.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about President Trump's promise to lower the cost of prescription drugs. And in a few minutes, we're also going to take a look at his other big promise in the State of the Union address when it comes to health care, giving patients better access to experimental treatments. You can join the conversation. Have you noticed an evolution of the president's position on lowering drug prices? Can he deliver in year two of his administration? I'm talking with Dylan Scott. He's a health policy reporter at Vox. And I'd like to turn as well now to Rachel Sachs. She's a professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. She closely follows drug pricing, and you can link to her piece headlined "How to Lower Drug Prices Without Lowering Drug Prices" at our website, onpointradio.org. And Rachel Sachs, welcome to On Point. It's really good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for having me.
Love to get your reaction. I know you've been listening along here. Your reaction to President Trump's pledge to bring down the cost of prescription drugs during the State of the Union address. What did you hear?
Well, I largely agree with Dylan. I'm quite skeptical of his comments. As you've been noting, we have seen somewhat of an evolution in the policy discussion from a discussion of list prices and drug companies that are abusing the system to high prices, high costs generally, which is something that can be addressed through some of these lowering of out-of-pocket payments that actually won't touch drug companies' bottom lines and may even bolster them. So I'm skeptical that we'll see the same president who criticized drug companies for getting away with murder. I think he's dropped some of that rhetoric, but I do think we will see some relief for a small subset of patients in Medicare Part D for whom some of these burdens are unsustainable.
Right. And can you tease that out a little bit? Dylan went into this. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but explain that a little bit. When we're talking about Medicaid Part D, and they actually have the right to negotiate directly with the drug companies, is that right? Do I have that right?
So plan sponsors, private plan sponsors, but not the Medicare program itself, are able to negotiate for the prices of these drugs. Mm-hmm. Part of, and Alex Azar noted this during his confirmation hearing, part of the problem is that by law, Medicare Part D is required to cover some or all of the drugs in a particular pharmaceutical class. So the president, who has touted his deal-making skills, must know that in order to get the best deal, sometimes you need to be able to say no, to walk away from the table. But if Medicare can't say no, if even these plan sponsors who are empowered to negotiate, they can't say no, they have to cover it, their ability to extract negotiated rebates is somewhat more limited. Of course, the flip side of that is then if we did want to give them the ability to say no, we would be restricting access to some of these medicines for Medicare beneficiaries. And that's a real policy discussion that's important to have, but it's not the one that we're having now.
Interesting. Rachel Sachs, I'm reading a comment from a listener on Facebook. J. Chris Henry writes, other countries have lower prescription medication prices because they have single-payer healthcare systems. As the provider for the nation, they negotiate lower bulk rates. I bring that into the conversation because is this idea of allowing Medicare to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical companies, is this kind of a silver bullet that would actually do the trick? I know that President Trump isn't talking about that now, but is that sort of like the holy grail of bringing drug prices down?
Unfortunately, no. I think Secretary Azar understands that drug pricing is not one problem. It's a whole set of different problems, and there's no one solution that will be able to get us out of this mess. But Jay is correct that other countries do have negotiators at the highest levels of government working on these questions, but often they have the ability to say no, as I was just mentioning, which is something that we've limited for different reasons in this country.
All right. Let's hear again from President Trump. This is from the State of the Union address. He's talking about the Food and Drug Administration, praising them for what he called exciting progress in this area.
To speed access to breakthrough cures and affordable generic drugs, last year, the FDA approved more new and generic drugs and medical devices than ever before in our country's history.
Dylan Scott, can you truth squad that for us or say a little bit more about what the president's referring to there?
Sure. And so he's talking about the work that the FDA, which approves prescription drugs that go on sale in the United States, the work that it's been doing over the last year. And in my conversations, including with Rachel, everybody that I've talked to, even if they're critical of the administration in general, have been pretty positive about the work that the FDA has been doing. They have been, as the president was alluding to, they have been taking steps to try to get more generic drugs, which are copies of the brand name prescription drugs that are then sold at a much lower price. They've been doing, you know, they have been working to increase competition in that space and get more generic drugs on the market. This is another place, though, where I think it's, you know, notable how, you know, this is a different conversation than the one that the president was talking about during his campaign. You know, the drug industry, the brand name pharmaceutical industry itself, you know, when the drug pricing conversation comes up, they'll say, you know, we would love to get more generic drugs onto the market because that's a more market-based sort of deregulatory approach to this issue. It's not more direct government intervention. And so I don't think that anybody would say that that more generic drugs going on sale in the U.S. is a bad thing. But it's, I think, also another example of the way that the discussion has changed over the last year.
Got it. And Rachel Sachs, what about you on this issue? What about what has the FDA done that is right on this issue? And what more could they do?
Well, I've been very pleased to see FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb take a number of actions to promote generic competition. And Dylan is right that we could have seen previously the president point to the FDA to say market forces and competition is how we're going to drive down prices. But that's not a match for the rhetoric against not just prices, but against the drug companies. So over the next year, you know, I certainly expect the FDA to continue with many of its efforts to promote generic competition. Some of the efforts they've begun may start to bear more tangible results. And Commissioner Gottlieb has also suggested that he would like to end some of the abuses that he sees companies engaging in. So things like closed distribution systems where companies, branded companies, might make it harder for generic versions of the product to come to market. He's concerned with that. And I wonder if we'll see some action at the agency level on that topic. But it's nibbling around the edges of a much larger question.
Well, let's get some listeners into this conversation. Let's begin with Sue, who's calling from Westport, New York. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there.
I have actually a comment and then a question following it. As I understand it, in order to put a new drug on the market, a large amount of money has to be paid to the FDA. And I believe that the amount is about $500,000. And this amount was actually set at the request of Big Pharma. And the reason is that it eliminates small startup companies from infringing on their business. And my question is this correct? And if so, doesn't it really create a monopoly and it prohibits competition where maybe the prices could be a little bit lower?
Okay, great question. Rachel Sachs, can you respond to Sue on that?
Right. So there are these prescription drug user fees that companies pay when they're trying to come to market. These user fees have been around since 1992. We reauthorize them every 5 years. And they've really made it easier for the FDA to approve these applications more quickly, with more attention, to staff up appropriately. The amount that companies have to pay to the FDA is very small in comparison to the amount they have to pay overall to get a drug through the long, complex, expensive clinical trials process. So I can't speak to whether I highly doubt that this was primarily driven by a desire to negatively impact small companies, but it has had a really positive impact on patients' ability to access these drugs more quickly and on the certainty of which companies can move forward through this process.
All right, Sue, thanks for that question. Let's go to Tom, who is calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. It's good to have you. What's on your mind?
The cheapest painkiller not on the market that they don't want to allow on the market right now is marijuana. And President Trump could take that off the Class A list, and so colleges and universities can research it. But the big trick they're using now is they have this time-release thing where the companies will put this time-release aspect into a drug that was going and losing its patent protection, and they give it more years of patent protection and a monopoly. So I'd like you to address maybe both those questions.
All right, Tom. Rachel Sachs, is that a question that you can take up?
Sure. So this idea that pharmaceutical companies are engaging in something that we often called evergreening, which is a process by which the companies try to obtain new patents to extend their monopolies over their existing products, it's been widely criticized. But there are the HHS and FDA are limited in their ability to do much about this problem on their own. You could expect a motivated president with the ability to shepherd not just these agencies, but the bureaucracy of the federal government more broadly. You could expect him to do something about it, but it's not clear, I think, that he appreciates the many different drivers of this problem and the way in which they fit together.
All right. Rachel Sachs, before we let you go on this question, because we're going to shift gears and talk about another issue shortly, but sort of the bottom line question that I have is, can President Trump take on this big problem of high drug prices without taking on drug companies more directly, holding them more accountable? In other words, is this effort going to be sort of a bite without fangs, I guess?
If he proceeds and if the administration proceeds down some of the avenues we've suggested in terms of helping patients with their out-of-pocket costs and promoting generic competition, there will be real tangible benefits for a small group of patients who truly need it. But it's not going to do anything to address the larger problem of list prices and overall spending, and it may even exacerbate it.
All right. Well, Rachel Sachs, law professor at Washington University in St. Louis, we appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dylan Scott, a health policy reporter for Vox, is still with us. And Dylan, I want to talk now to this other big pledge President Trump made in Tuesday's speech to a joint session of Congress, and that's the right to try experimental treatments. Here's a bit of what he said.
People who are terminally ill should not have to go from country to country to seek a cure. I want to give them a chance right here at home. It's time for Congress to give these wonderful, incredible Americans the right to try.
So, Dylan, remind us, what is right to try legislation?
Sure. So the gist of right to try is that we should make it much easier, as the president said, for people who have are terminally ill to try basically any experimental treatment that has passed sort of just the baseline safety tests in their clinical trials. And it's a popular idea among conservatives, among libertarians. The idea is that we try to get the FDA bureaucracy out of the way. And, you know, as long as a patient and their doctor and the drug company agree to let the patient try this experimental treatment, then they should be allowed to try it. It's picked up a lot of steam over the last few years. I think about 30 or so states have actually passed their own right to try legislation. Obviously, that has limited effect because the FDA, a federal agency, is actually responsible for prescription drugs. And so state law can only do so much. And there has been some movement in both the House and the Senate. I believe the Senate has actually passed a right to try bill last year. And so, you know, this is one of those places where it's, to be candid, it's sort of a compassionate thing that on prescription drugs and kind of medical treatment that conservatives and libertarians can get behind because it's deregulatory. It's about people being allowed to choose their own treatments. It's particularly, I think, it's notable. Of course, the president made this comment in his State of the Union address, but I have gotten the sense over the last year that this is a much more of a priority for Vice President Mike Pence and some Republicans in Congress. But it's certainly notable that the president would devote some time to it during his State of the Union.
And of course, there's some big concerns about it, which we're going to hear in a minute. We'd love to get the listeners in on this conversation as well. Listeners, do we need experimental treatment and right to try legislation at the federal level? Several states already have it. To talk a little more about this part of the plan, joining me from New York is Allison Bateman House. She's a professor in the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University. She also co-chairs and the NYU School of Medicine's Working Group on Compassionate Use and Pre-Approval Process. And Allison Bateman House, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for letting me join you.
I'd love to hear your reaction to the president's call for a federal right to try law.
Well, unfortunately, I was dismayed to hear it. The president said patients should not have to travel from country to country to seek access to, you know, potentially life-saving treatments. And patients don't have to do that currently. Since the late 1970s, patients have been able to access unapproved experimental drugs, devices, vaccines, you name it, right here in the United States. Does that mean that some patients don't, you know, choose to go overseas? Yes, some patients choose to go to Mexico or to the UK or other places for a variety of reasons, including economic. You know, sometimes things are just cheaper abroad. But to make it sound like there's some sort of prohibition on people getting access to treatments here is a gross misrepresentation of reality. And I think it does a great disservice to people who are terminally ill and are looking for treatments to make them think that right now they don't have access to anything.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're discussing the healthcare policy proposal ideas that President Trump touched on during Tuesday night's State of the Union address. You can join the conversation. We're talking right now about federal right to try legislation. Do we need experimental treatment and right to try legislation at the federal level, which the president has proposed? Doctors, patients, how would you be affected? And I'm talking with Dylan Scott, health policy reporter for Vox, and Allison Bateman House, a medical ethicist at New York University School of Medicine. And Allison, before the break, you were talking about it's already possible to get these experimental drugs and treatments. Where's the misunderstanding? Where's the disconnect? Why this idea that people can't get them, and so we need this legislation?
Well, I think you need to look at where the idea of this right to try legislation came from. It was conceived of by a libertarian organization called the Goldwater Institute. And if you read the text of the legislation, it squarely blames any problems in getting access to drugs on the FDA. Now, if you look at the data, the FDA approves 99.9% or at least 99.something% of all requests that come to it. And it does so very rapidly, same day for an emergency request, within 4 days on average for non-emergency request. So unfortunately, the idea that the FDA is what is impeding patients' access to drugs is, I would say, a fabrication. And I would say it's in service of promoting a deregulatory agenda that wants to rein in the power of the FDA. Are there problems getting access to drugs? Yes. Are they to be put at the foot of the FDA? No.
So what is your concern? We made clear that you're a medical ethicist, among other things. What's your concern about where this will lead? Because this is one of those things, I think you'll agree with this, that in a way it's easy to promote. I mean, it's easy to sort of say, oh my gosh, there are people out there who are dying. They're in their last days. Here's an opportunity to get a drug. They can't get it. Pass a law. Let them take matters into their own hands. It's a hard one to argue against initially. But what are the ethical concerns about where this can lead?
Well, before I get into the weeds of the ethics, I just want to say on the surface, the ethical concern is that those promoting this policy tell patients, particularly those who are dying, it's going to help them. And this is not a policy that is going to help anyone. On sheer practical grounds, nobody is going to get access to a drug under a right to try law. Testifying before the House of Representatives committee hearing on this issue, Ken Mock, who is a longtime drug industry expert, a head of many advisory groups within the pharmaceutical industry, said point blank, no ethical company will provide drug under right to try. And so you have to wonder about a legislation that is only going to make access available to something put out by unethical companies looking to make money off of desperate people.
So that's really the concern. So basically, we're talking about a process that would take the FDA out of the equation. And so you're saying that would sort of pave the way to these unethical companies essentially selling vulnerable people a bill of goods.
Precisely. So if I can just explain very briefly the process as it exists now, you have to find a doctor who's willing to administer an experimental drug to you. You know, obviously the FDA has no role in you finding a doctor. That doctor has to contact the drug company and ask for access to the experimental product. Again, the FDA has nothing to do with that. It is only after the drug company says yes that the FDA gets involved. And what we know is that the vast number of cases where patients do not get access happens at the point of requesting from the drug company. So if you want to truly enable patients to have more easy access to investigational drugs, you have to figure out what are the drug company's concerns about this and how do you address those. And the FDA is somewhat involved in that in terms of the drug company's concerns may have something to do with the FDA, but it's a very sort of secondary issue. It's not where I would say this is the main point to hammer on.
Mm. Well, listeners, we've got some listeners who want to get in on this particular part of the conversation, so let's go to them now. Gail is calling from Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Gail, you're on the air. It's good to have you. Tell me what's on your mind.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I used to work for a medical health care company that did make drugs, like 20 years ago or so, even more than that. The company was looking at trying to get clinical human trials for one of their products, and they were having difficulty doing it. And I think that the people that were involved in it at the time were drawing over that ethical line because they were trying to find ways to use this product on people when there was no other course for them to take because they didn't know their blood type, and they were going to administer this, and they were going to a hospital to try to get their clinical trials. And I think what's going on now, that's what I'm hearing now, is that looking to cross some kind of a line now to get free research from these from people who are in a dire situation. And that's my concern, because they're running out of ways to keep the investors happy with the money they keep taking off the top.
Boy, Gail, that's a dramatic way to put it. Allison Bateman House, respond to that. I mean, this idea that this new proposal is a way of getting free research, using vulnerable people as guinea pigs to do free research. Do you see it that way?
I'd have to hear the details more to understand exactly what the caller was saying. But no, I don't think so. I do want to mention, I'm glad she mentioned clinical trials. You know, obviously, the sort of most common way that people get access to an investigational product is via a clinical trial. So one of the things that is currently being pursued, aside from Right to Try, is the idea of why are so many people denied the ability to participate in a clinical trial. And the fact is, clinical trials are centered in major academic medical centers. They're in, major population centers. If you live in a rural area or a remote area away from a teaching hospital, you can't enroll just due to pragmatic difficulties or whatnot. So there's actually a lot of activity right now to try to push trials out and also to lower the inclusion criteria, saying, well, fine, so your cancer's metastasized. That doesn't mean we don't want you in this trial. Let's go ahead and focus on getting children and the elderly and whatnot. The FDA is actually having a open public meeting in the next couple of weeks about this. All of your listeners would be able to participate or at least watch the webcast if they wanted to weigh in on this. And it's the idea of, we want to get people access to experimental drugs, but we want to do it in the best and safest possible way.
Mm-hmm.
And getting people into clinical trials is one way.
Let's take another call. Sequoia is calling from Asheville, North Carolina. Sequoia, you're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. I'm actually the mother of a chronically ill child, and a clinical trial, a medicine that was used in a clinical trial, is what saved my son's life. And so I absolutely believe in the legislation Right to Try.
Sequoia, I'm glad you put that point on the table. Allison Bateman House, I mean, respond to Sequoia, because this is the argument you're going to hear again and again from folks who are in favor of this.
Sure. Well, her son, fortunately and wonderfully, was saved by a drug that was received through a clinical trial. As I just said, one of our points that we're working on at the moment is trying to make clinical trials available to more people. So, yay, clinical trials. The concept of a right to try is not in any way, shape, or form similar to that. In fact, one of the bills that's currently pending in the House explicitly forbids allowing the reporting of any adverse events that happen in a right to try context.
Mm.
So you're not getting usable data out of this. A clinical trial is done, yes, we want to be able to help the patients who are in it, but it's to get data to bring drugs to market to help a whole nother generation of patients. That doesn't happen in this at all. And just to, to tag back into what your previous caller was saying, I want to make sure that there's a very bright line between what is called, quote unquote, compassionate use or expanded access and clinical trials. Clinical trials get data. Compassionate use or expanded access quite frequently does not involve any data collection. It is purely an attempt to try to help that patient right then and there.
Got it. Dylan Scott, I'm wondering if you can chime in here. Are patient groups, physician groups, reacting to this idea? And if so, are they divided? What are you hearing?
I think it doesn't break down too neatly. As far as I'm aware, Allison might know better than I do. But I do think one element that's important to keep in mind, and it kind of goes back to one of Allison's key points, is, you know, the pharmaceutical industry especially, and really I think the entire healthcare sector, is very invested in what's known as kind of the FDA gold standard, which is just this sort of idea that the FDA is rigorous when they review drugs and review clinical trials. And everybody is interested in that being the case, because it doesn't do anybody good for bad drugs to get out onto the market. And so I do think that the risk that comes with right to try that would concern doctors and patients as much as the pharmaceutical industry is that when you take that sort of independent arbiter out of the equation, you open yourself up to you know, outright fraud or just more sort of risks to right. The patient than you would see if the FDA was at least there to provide some oversight.
Boy, lots to think about. Dylan and Allison, you've given us a lot more to think about. Dylan Scott, health policy reporter at Vox, thank you so much for joining us today and for being so helpful.
Thanks for having me.
And Allison Bateman House, professor of medical ethics at New York University, thank you as well. It was great to have you.
Love to come back again. Thank you.
All right, listeners, in a moment, titans of industry want to add American healthcare to their portfolio. Stay with us. We're going to be talking about that. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. On Tuesday, three giants of commerce and banking teamed up to announce a partnership related to employee healthcare. Their goal, to improve employee satisfaction while reducing overall costs. There's a lot we don't know about this, but the combined market power of Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, and Berkshire Hathaway could have a dramatic impact on American healthcare overall. So joining me now to talk about this from Bethesda, Maryland, to explain what we know is Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And you can find his reporting on this at our website, onpointradio.org. And Noam, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Good to be with you.
So we're talking about Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan Chase. Remind us exactly what these three giants announced earlier this week.
Well, they made some big promises and some big waves in the healthcare world. They said they were going to join together to form some as yet unspecified partnership that they said would improve employee satisfaction and reduce costs for their million or so employees. Not clear exactly what that means, though, and a lot more questions now than answers, frankly.
Right. So let me start with some of the questions. What are your big questions about what that means? Give me the top two or three.
Well, I think the biggest question, I think, here is that there seems a growing consensus, I think, across American healthcare that the problem with American healthcare is prices, prices, prices.
Right.
We don't use hospitals more than other people. We don't go to the doctor more frequently than our counterparts in Western Europe and other industrialized countries, but we pay a heck of a lot more every time we use healthcare here. So the question is, can these three guys, can their partnership drive down prices across the larger healthcare system? They're big, but we're a country of 300 million people. Mm. They're not that big. And so these are obviously very smart people, very innovative. No one believed Amazon could do what it was going to do. So, you know, there's a fair amount of feeling, I think, don't bet against Amazon, don't bet against Jeff Bezos. Others have tried this. Other large employers have tried this in the past in one way or another. Boeing, for example, in the greater Northwest has done some innovative things. It has a very large number of employees in the Puget Sound area. As one of my colleagues pointed out, CalPERS, which is the fund that administers retirement benefits for California public employees, 1.4 million lives there. They've done some innovative stuff, too. But they haven't solved the problem across the whole healthcare system.
You know, it's fun to imagine what we might be talking about here. I mean, I came across sort of this tongue-in-cheek idea that when it comes to Amazon's involvement in this, are we talking about using drones to fly in low-cost doctors right to your home? Obviously, sort of a joke there. But what kinds of opportunities excite you? I mean, I know there are potential pitfalls as well, but talk about an opportunity or two.
Well, I think, before I get to opportunity, let me just say that I think one of the problems here is this notion that sort of there may be some high-tech gimmick that's going to solve the problem. I mean, we sort of know, as I said, that prices are too high. We also know that patients are not necessarily getting the care they need at the right time. The sickest patients are driving up the cost for everyone. And that's not a high-tech problem necessarily. It's a problem of just getting the right medical care to those people. Now, if these guys can figure out some ways to eliminate waste in the system by buying drugs, for example, at a lower price for their employees, for pressuring hospitals, say, that work with their employees to give a larger discount on what they charge, that I think has some real possibility. Again, it would need to be replicated across the whole system, and it should be noted Medicare has been trying to do this for decades, and it should be noted has actually been pretty successful. Medicare has, you know, 50, 60, 70 million Americans, Medicaid another 70 million Americans. These are programs that have been actually pretty successful at basically regulating price that they pay to hospitals, drugs, and doctors for the medical care they provide.
The
real hole has been is in Amazon's, the big employers, what they're paying, and as a result, what their employees are paying.
All right, that's Noam Levy talking about some big opportunities. Still lots of questions about this. He's national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
You can continue, listeners, the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Follow me on Twitter at Anthony G. Brooks. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.